you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We come your way from the Moen Broadcast Center. And we have a jam-packed, terrific program lined up for you today, as I mentioned with Frank a moment ago. LAPD Chief Dominic Choi is going to be with us. We'll talk with him about a number of developments with the department. But first, we take a look at national news, which, of course, has an impact here in Southern California involving the enforcement of immigration laws. The state of Texas seeking the authority to allow local law enforcement to detain and state judges to be able to designate for deportation or for misdemeanor or even felony conviction those who have entered the United States illegally along the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas. Joining us is national reporter for The Washington Post, who covers the U.S. southern border, Arelis Hernandez. Thank you very much, Arelis, for joining us. Yesterday, we had the U.S. Supreme Court saying they weren't going to weigh in. It wasn't ripe yet, that the Fifth District needed to reconsider what was happening with the implementation of the Texas law. Then what happened later yesterday?
Well, we heard from the Supreme Court, and first of all, it's a pleasure to be here, but we heard from the Supreme Court that the law could go ahead and take effect, and there was sort of an urgency or a nod from Justice Amy Coney Barrett to the Fifth Circuit that, you know, they needed to resolve this and that they needed to move quickly on this. And, you know, at first it was hailed as a victory that, you know, Texas would get to start enforcing this particular law. And then around 10 o'clock last night, the Fifth Circuit came back, blocked the law again. And we, I think oral arguments just wrapped up here in Texas, I mean, in Louisiana in the Fifth Circuit.
All right. So the Fifth, because didn't the Fifth initially allow it to go through? And then we had yesterday, the Fifth came back and on the appeal and said no on a 2-1 vote. And then, as you said, the arguments were actually presented today in court. Do we have any sense of how the judges on the Fifth Circuit responded to the competing presentations?
Well, what I've heard so far and in listening to some of the arguments back and forth today, what we expect, hasn't been any kind of ruling, but what we expect is for them to figure out whether the law can go into effect and whether they can strip out, like, for example, those deportation orders that or just give, you know, allow the law to go into effect, just the arrest portion of that. It's not clear to me where the Fifth Circuit is on that particular, or whether we're going to see later on today's or tomorrow, whether this law could in fact take effect, whether in part or in the whole. But to be clear, they, you know, the district court, which is a court lower than that, had already said that, you know, this law is unconstitutional, would create a whole new system just for Texas. And that's the decision that they had stayed initially.
All right. So yet to be determined. And at issue is whether under the U.S. Constitution, Texas has the authority to do this. Arelis, can you just get into that a little bit more? What are the competing interpretations of U.S. law regarding local law enforcement's latitude here?
Well, there really isn't much interpretation here. I mean, it's been pretty clear in the Constitution and in talking to constitutional lawyers that immigration enforcement and control over the borders is the province of the federal government and has been for 150 years since the Civil War. And so that's sort of the standing, the argument that the federal government is making. What Texas is putting forth is that, you know, the federal government has absconded essentially their responsibility in protecting their borders, has thus exposed Texas to harm. Therefore, they have the authority to step in here and invoke the invasion clause of the Constitution, both the U.S. and state constitution, and say, well, you know, if the federal government's not going to protect us, then we will, then we have the right to do that.
And the exception under the Constitution for a state to be involved is when a state is, quote, actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. And that is what is being contested, whether a surge in unauthorized immigration, whether that qualifies as an invasion or imminent danger. And that's the issue that really is at play here. Now, civil liberties attorneys in Texas say their big concern isn't just for those who are unauthorized in the U.S. who've crossed the border at Texas, but the issue of those who are Latino Americans who are going to be potentially subject to stop and demands that they prove that they're in the country legally. And share with us a bit, you know, some of those concerns and what advocates have said of this.
No, that's exactly right. But because this is a law that doesn't just apply to the borderlands or the border region, but the state as a whole, anyone who a peace officer in the state of Texas potentially is suspected of having crossed the border illegally is subject or is potentially vulnerable to arrest and to going through this entire process. Now, the enforcement part of this is not super, super clear. I don't know if you saw, but a bunch of police stations yesterday or police departments talked about the ways they might implement this or that they might, you know, not enforce this the way perhaps that the law was conceived. But there are a lot of questions about how that would work. But yes, civil rights advocates in particular are concerned for anyone who, you know, essentially is non-white in the state of Texas could be vulnerable to arrest under this law.
Yeah, and particularly I saw the concern is people that don't speak English, say they only speak Spanish, that would be a point of suspicion as to whether they're in the country legally. And of course, we have, you know, millions of Americans who don't speak English and speak Spanish or other languages from their country of origin. We're talking with Aurelis Hernandez, national reporter for The Washington Post, who covers the U.S. southern border, immigration, and the state of Texas, talking with her about this case for which arguments just wrapped out before the Fifth Circuit U.S. Appellate Court on this issue of whether Texas, citing this provision within the Constitution of being actually invaded or in imminent danger, that they can take this enforcement measure. I did see that the Houston Police Department, Aurelis, expressed a considerable concern about how they would enforce this.
Yes, Houston, Fort Worth, I think even Bexar County, which is home to San Antonio, some of the bigger departments are really worried because to justify an arrest, you need probable cause. And it's not super clear because there haven't been guidelines or regulatory provisions provided as to, you know, what would constitute a reasonable suspicion that somebody had entered the country illegally. Is it Spanish speaking? And that's where the concern is that this could lead to mass racial profiling and then thus expose these police officers to liability because, you know, police work is supposed to happen in a non-discriminatory manner.
All right. Aurelis, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it very much. Aurelis Hernandez, national reporter for The Washington Post. And of course, throughout the day here from NPR News, you're going to be hearing reporting on those arguments that were presented before the Fifth District Court of Appeals, Fifth Circuit. So that's coming up throughout the day in our hourly NPR newscasts. And of course, starting at 1 o'clock on All Things Considered with Austin Cross here on LAist 89.3.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, and so appropriate that our civics and democracy and longtime law enforcement reporter for LAist, Frank Stolz, just happens to be here to oversee the interview with the new chief of the LAPD, interim chief of the department until a permanent successor is chosen under a five-year term, Dominic Choi. Chief Choi, welcome to Air Talk. So good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Was it a tough decision for you when you were approached for this? Because you had to say you were not going to compete for the full five-year term. You were going to be the interim and hold it at that. Was that tough for you to accept under those terms?
Well, I think running for the chief position, whether it's interim or full-time chief, is a tough decision. As we all know, it's a very demanding job. It takes a lot of your time away. I've always grown up in the organization talking about balance in life and work, my personal life and work. And quite frankly, it's a struggle to balance that in this position because of the responsibilities that it bears. So I really had to give it some thought to say, am I willing to, we'll use the words off balance, commit to a little bit of an off balance life. Work is extremely demanding, and would I commit to that for this position?
Well, and I'm assuming you would have been a strong candidate for the full five-year term. So you have to make a decision about, do you take this now when it's offered under the terms, you won't go for that? Or do you say, no, thank you, I want to compete for the permanent job?
Well, of course, I think I'm qualified. Otherwise, I wouldn't have put my name in hat for the interim job. Again, this job is, it's for me, it's not for the title, it's not for the pay. There was a need in the organization, and the officers need strong leadership, and the community needs a strong leader in the organization as we serve the community. So that's why I did it. My timeline is I have a set time, personal timeline for me, and nobody goes for the permanent chief's position for a one-year, five-year term, right? Everybody wants to try for the second term. That's another five years. So in good conscience, I don't have 10 years left in me in the city. I've already been here over 28 years. And I understand you're gonna ask me, well, Michael Moore has been here for 42 plus years.
Yeah, he's a lifer.
Yeah. I have my own personal timeline. Again, my balance with my personal life and work life, I want to be true to that goal. I have a wife and three daughters that are waiting for me to spend more time with them, and I want to stand by that personal goal.
All right. So you don't necessarily see this position as a potential setting you up to be chief of another major American department after this interim tenure is up?
I don't, no.
Really? Okay. Are you going to feel comfortable continuing, say, as assistant chief under your successor?
Absolutely. I think so one of the things that I've done is When I became the interim chief, I did not fill or promote somebody into my assistant chief position. That was intentional. What I'm doing is I'm rotating my deputy chiefs. So as the director of operations, I have four deputy chiefs. I'm rotating them in monthly so they get the experience to know what it's like to be an assistant chief, a little more broad span and control, a little more decision-making responsibility. And it's really about, and those four assistant chiefs come from a diverse background of ethnicity as well as gender. And I saw that as an opportunity to really mentor these folks and to prepare them, quite frankly, to, if they want to run for the permanent chief, that they can do that as well.
Chief Choi, I'm wondering, you mentioned about the diversity and rotating people through your former position. You're Korean-American, born in L.A., grew up in Orange County, a local guy. And I wonder if you've heard from people in the Korean-American community of Los Angeles congratulating you or being particularly proud, given your ethnicity, of the position you're holding.
Absolutely. If you can imagine, I've had numerous phone calls, texts, conversations and community meetings with the Korean American community. I've been a excuse me. I've been a long time part of that community. Growing up, you know, I went to USC. I worked at the Crenshaw Mall and the Bank of America as a teller. You know, trying to help put myself through college. My father worked in Crenshaw, off of Crenshaw and Exposition for 35 plus years. My mom had a wig and beauty supply off of 6th and Normandy. And then we have other family, obviously, in this city. But so I've always been part of the Korean community here in Los Angeles. But in this role, obviously being much more visible to that community, I've attended several community events, built relationships over the years. So it's not just as a command officer that I've engaged this community. As a young officer, I also was in that community meeting with community members, and I've fostered those relationships over the years. And then they've become friendships and true relationships where they can call me if something's wrong in the community, if they have a concern in the community, the way we're policing or something that we could be doing that we're not doing. So yes, all those individuals that I've built relationships with over the years have reached out, congratulating me, and you know, we're going to continue to work professionally together.
So they've been following you as you've made this journey through the department. That's fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah. We're talking with Dominic Choi, who's the interim chief of the Los Angeles Police Department. If you have questions for him, you can call us at 866-893-5722. You can also email your question to atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Let's talk a bit about your previous job as homeless coordinator for the department, because, of course, you're now the point person for the law enforcement interfacing with those living on the streets and in vehicles in the city of Los Angeles. What, given your experience in that previous job with the department, do you feel like you're bringing to your work as the chief?
Well, I think in that position, I was able, and through now, I was able to see intimately and closely kind of the evolution of how LAPD has involved themselves or been asked to be involved in homelessness as a law enforcement entity. When I first started as the homeless coordinator, we were really capturing or recapping how many citations, how many arrests, those type of behaviors, right? And that was obviously frowned upon. We can't arrest our way out of a social issue. And then we, during my time as the homeless coordinator, then we created these HOPE teams where they would go out and do outreach because we could, you know, enforcing wasn't working. So we'd start doing outreach and doing referrals to the service providers. And we were, you know, we were really one of the very few entities that were out there 24/7. So we were doing so many referrals to these entities that these service providers couldn't handle the number of referrals that were coming in. And really what ended up happening is you have some homelessness that's occurring in a particular, encampment or whatever, and you have, let's say, 10, 15 people there. Five of them want to talk to you and they need services. So you go, okay, I'm going to refer them. We refer them, but because there's, thousands of referrals sitting there in the queue, that person, those five people that want services, don't end up getting them because it takes so long for the service providers back then to get to these referrals.
But so much money has come into those services now. Is there still
it's changed. So that's what I've seen the whole evolution for LAPD going from enforcement to referrals or trying to provide services to now what we're at a kind of a hybrid model, right? So what we're doing is we're going out there, we're working with council offices and the service providers, identify problematic encampments. We will go in there as law enforcement if there's any criminal behavior, prostitution, narcotics activity, human trafficking, any of that type of stuff. We will address that from a law enforcement perspective, just like we would any other type of crime, not withholding or holding back because it's a homeless encampment. Criminal behavior is criminal behavior, and we have to stop it. It's creating a safe environment for that encampment. And once that encampment is safe, then we go out there and we'll do progressive contacts. So the first one is, hey, you can't have your tents up, you're blocking the side. All these, we'll give them warnings. We'll discuss with them. We'll try and identify service providers to come in and help them. If that if services are refused, ultimately when an inside safe operation comes in, then we'll go and make sure those service providers are safe to house these individuals. So that's kind of we've used this progressive model. I think it's been working and successful.
For those that have not been cooperative and there have been laws broken in those cases, are you getting what you feel is sufficient support from the LA City Attorney's Office on the misdemeanor side and from the DA's office on the felony side?
Yes, we are. We are. So we have the 4118 Los Angeles Municipal
Anti-Camping Ordinances, yes. Is colloquially called.
So there's we actually track every single one of those that are written, and we look to make sure that there's been multiple contacts with the individual that is cited and that resources or services have been offered, that warnings have been given before that citation is written. Every division that goes out there and does that enforcement, that's what we'd look at monthly to make sure that that type of enforcement posture is being maintained. Once those are filed, we haven't had a problem getting them filed. I'm not aware of too many felony cases that go to the DA that have been rejected, as long as we have the right probable cause and the correct information on these arrest reports. But that's really separate and apart from homelessness. Any felony crime we're going to enforce regardless of whether it's a person experiencing homelessness or somebody who's not.
We're talking with the interim chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, Dominic Choi, with us on Air Talk, and we welcome your questions at 866-893-5722 or LAist.com. LAist.com/airtalk. You can see where to put your question in there, or you can email us at atcomments@LAist.com. Wanted to talk about some of the drops we've seen in violent crime. It went down like 3% last year overall. Homicides were down more markedly last year, so it was a good year generally in seeing that decrease. But there still is the perception among many that Los Angeles isn't a particularly safe city. Probably a couple things help fuel that. One, the smash and grabs, which are shocking and come on people totally unawares and put a great deal of threat on employees and any customers in the environment. But also we've seen things like knifings and you know, attacks on public transit and things that give people a sense that the city is unsafe and that there are those behaving erratically who can be a threat to them at any given moment. That's sort of separate and apart from statistics and what it says about your odds of that happening. So what do you see as the department's role in giving people a sense, based on accurate events, that the city is safe for people to use public transit, to be walking in most parts of the city, to feel that they're secure?
So a couple parts to that question. In 2023, we did see a reduction in crime overall. And this year, what we're seeing is we are seeing a slight uptick in our homicides, our robberies.
So far this year.
Yes.
Okay.
And our property crime as well. We're seeing motor vehicle theft on the increase, and we're seeing a slight increase in burglaries, although we're flattening out or leveling out there. So like you said, those are just statistics. And I always talk about this when I go out and talk to the public, is if you're that one person that was a victim of that crime, it doesn't matter what the statistics are. Your sense of safety is eroded. I mean, there's no way around that, right?
And it's type of crime. It's like if it's a home invasion versus it's a cold burglary and people are at work.
Yeah.
Those, they may have the same, you know, they may be classified similarly, but the feeling is totally different.
Even if you're not home, it's still an invasion of your privacy. You feel violated, and we have to be aware of that. So part of our mission as the LAPD, and I think most agencies, is not only trying to reduce the incidence of crime, but also reduce the fear or the perception of crime. And the way we do that is through our community policing strategy, right? We have our CSP, or Community Safety Partnership Bureaus. We have these senior lead officers. They're all engaging and informing community members of what we're doing. And I think when the community has personal relationships with our department, that sense of safety or security, just having somebody that you know you can call, somebody you know you can talk to. If you call a certain number, someone's going to pick up. Creating that environment for community members will create that sense of safety. There was a recent sentiment survey, I forget who actually conducted it, but some of the highest or most positive sentiments about policing and the relationships with police are in some of our highest crime areas. So the perception of crime or the feeling of safety doesn't necessarily always correlate with the number of crimes in an area. So hopefully I answered your question.
Yeah, and I do think sort of the randomness part of that equation is a big challenge. When people feel like they don't know what they're going to be facing when they're out in the world, that heightens this concern about violence and crime. We're talking with Dominic Choi, the chief of the Los Angeles Police Department. He's serving in an interim capacity until the choice is made for the permanent successor, who will be chosen for a 5-year term with the option to come up again pending the approval of the mayor to a second 5-year term. This all was put in place because LAPD Chief Michael Moore, the previous chief, announced he was going to retire earlier than planned, just about a year into that second term. Again, if you have questions for Chief Choi, we're at 866-893-5722. It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. Thank you so much for your support. We deeply appreciate it. We're talking with the interim chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, Dominic Choi. We've talked about homelessness. He brings particular expertise and experience to that, being the coordinator of that sector of the LAPD earlier in his career. And we're talking with him now about a variety of challenges. I do want to, because of listener Joel in Santa Monica, raised this issue with you. Joel says, we've been reading about the civilian misconduct boards, that they are more lenient than the former boards that exclusively had sworn officers on them. What is your position on how those boards of rights and the hearings should be composed and conducted?
Well, first of all, I think we have to look at it from a community perspective, right? So we have a discipline system. The community expects that that process is transparent, that it's fair, but it also holds officers accountable for egregious misconduct. And quite frankly, when an officer, based on their behavior, shouldn't be a police officer or can't carry out the essential functions, that we need to be able to terminate them or remove them from the organization. In 2019, a pilot program was put into place. So prior to 2019, our Board of Rights were comprised of two sworn command officers and one civilian hearing examiner. In this pilot program in 2019, when it started, it went to an all-civilian border rights panel. What we've seen, this is not, you know, a month or a year worth of data, this is 4+ years of data that we've seen. Consistently, what we've seen is when the chief of police directs somebody to a board of rights for termination, a recommendation of termination, that's another issue I'll get to in a second, but recommends termination to an individual, that case is put on. We've consistently seen these civilian boards not terminate these employees, but give extensive suspension days, like 45 suspension days, 65 suspension days. Now, the chief of police is only limited to 22 suspension days. After that, he will direct somebody to a board of rights. He's not allowed to give more than that. But quite frankly, if you need more than 22 suspension days, there's probably a negative retention issue here. You just can't. We shouldn't be a police officer.
Now the union, I just want to interject. Their argument is that if you have the majority of sworn officers on the Board of Rights panel, they're going to feel beholden to the chief because they're concerned about job security and they don't want to be, so they're going to rubber stamp, is the argument, essentially what the chief has called for in the termination, as opposed to take a fully comprehensive look and all what might be mitigating circumstances where the officer is accused. That's their perspective. So what do you say in response to that?
Well, I say there's no perfect system, but I think if you look at disciplinary systems across the nation, we have the most thorough, the most robust, and quite frankly, the most fair discipline system, in my opinion. However, when you have somebody that has, and I'll just give you examples, somebody that has clearly or admittedly lied during an investigation, covered up misconduct, or was found guilty of an egregious assault, let's say off duty, for the chief of police not to be able to remove that person and be forced to put that person back in the workplace through a pre-established process, I think is unfair to the community. First of all, taxpayer dollars are feeding our budget. And that person now cannot go out there and police. So what does that person do?
Because they have no credibility to testify in the prosecution.
Yeah, and if they collect evidence and they got a sustained complaint for lying, they're going to lose the case. They're going to be tested on their honesty, right? So what does that person do that's making a sworn police officer salary? They do administrative work, clerical work, which is paid at a lower rate. So we're paying somebody at a higher rate to do less work with public funds. And so we have to be clear about that. So there's more than, it's not the, we're not looking, I'm not looking for having the chief be able to have this authority, superior authority to just terminate it at will. There's a responsibility that we have to the public and to our police department to make sure that people that shouldn't be police officers are not. And that's all we're asking for.
Well, and clearly the attorneys for the department have to be making this case before the Board of Rights hearing, saying, look, if this officer isn't terminated, she or he is going to be in a neutered position with the department where they can't really do the duties of a full sworn officer. But it sounds like in many cases the Board of Rights, the board is sort of siding weighing with the livelihood of the officer over what this means for taxpayers and the department.
I would say generally that's an accurate statement. There have been one or two cases that I'm aware of, and it's very, very rare, where a board of rights will increase increase the penalty. So, for example, an officer gets a 10-day suspension, and he or she thinks that's too many days for what I did. That officer can opt for board of rights. Now, it's not directed by the chief of police. The officer opts to go to a board of rights to contest the penalty. So when they go to contest the penalty, that board of rights can actually increase the penalty. So there is some risk there on the officer's behalf. On one or two occasions that I'm aware of, that occurred, but very, very rarely does that occur. So
let me just ask you about the budget crisis. That's probably too strong a term. The budget challenge the city of Los Angeles is facing. Crisis gets thrown around probably too much. But they're facing a big gap at this point. And the city administrative officer is saying that there are about 2,000 city jobs that at this point should probably not be filled because there's not the money to hire for those jobs. Councilmember Ulises Hernandez has said that really would be better, instead of that, to do the cuts with the LAPD as opposed to, you know, cross the city with all these different positions. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is, and I think we all know this, unless you have a safe city and you have a strong public safety arm, you don't have a flourishing city or a vibrant city. And that's just reality. However you want to explain that or describe it, that I believe that to be the truth. We are short officers. We are short our police service representatives, those individuals handling or calling, picking up the phone when you call 911. If we don't have somebody answer that call and we don't have people to respond to those calls, I will tell you right now that our public safety will erode. And I can't let that happen, and I can't support cutting LAPD's budget as it relates to hiring, freezing our hiring.
Yeah, if you didn't fill the currently open positions, are you saying this would be a significant threat to public safety?
Absolutely. We have to have enough police officers to police this city. If you look at, I want to say, Chicago and New York, I think per capita, per 100,000 residents, they're at about 4.7, 4.2 roughly officers per 100,000 residents. We're at 2.1 or 2.2.
And it's pretty much always been that way in Los Angeles.
It has. Now, in fairness, we do police a little differently. We don't have a cop standing on every street corner and things like, we don't bring our police officers out in vans and drop them off. We two-person cars, and we're 400-plus square miles. So, there's a clear point here that we are understaffed. We've been understaffed. We've been making it work, and we've been innovative and creative, and our officers are very hardworking, and they're doing great things every day. But there will be a breaking point. We may have to look at an organizational structural change. Again, part of my job as interim is to identify what needs are to happen in the long run, and then hand that information off to the incoming chief.
Chief Choi, thank you very much. Really appreciate your coming in, spending time with us this morning. We'll look forward to it next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. It was great seeing you both.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. A few days ago, caught an article in the LA Times by education writer Howard Bloom about how a proposed ballot measure, an initiative, is raising signatures to qualify in an upcoming election. And it would require that California personal finance classes are taught in our public schools in the state of California. This initiative is funded by the head of a nonprofit known as Next Gen Personal Finance, Tim Ranzetta, who joins us. Next Gen Personal Finance provides free personal finance curriculum and professional development to more than 30,000 middle and high school teachers. Tim Ranzetta, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this initiative.
Larry, it's great to be with you today.
So share with us about how many you've collected and where you're at in the point of submitting them.
Yeah, so last week we announced that we had more than enough signatures to get on the November ballot. What does that mean? Close to 900,000 California voters signed on to the petition, and we basically need 550. So we've got a margin of safety there. The signatures have all been delivered to the county registrars, and so they'll be counting those, and we expect to be officially certified the end of April, early May.
Now, why not working through the state legislature, since we're talking about something of, you know, a requirement as part of the curriculum of public schools? Why not do it legislatively instead of through initiative?
Yeah, great point. And so we've actually had success. We have an affiliated organization that has advocated for this in many states across the nation. And in fact, in the last 2.5 years, 17 states, the legislatures have passed laws that require every high school student to take a one semester standalone personal finance course. We made an attempt last year. However, the bill, according to the author, Assemblymember McCarty, was watered down in committee and didn't make any progress. I've looked at the history of this, and it's basically been 2 decades of legislative efforts. And unfortunately, where we find ourselves today is California is one of 4 states that earned an F in terms of access to personal finance education from a report by the Center for Financial Literacy. So, yes, ideally, we would work through the legislature. And actually, there's a new bill that was introduced again by Assemblymember McCarty, which mirrors the initiative language that was introduced last month. That's AB 2927. Ultimately, this is about ensuring every high school student in California receives the benefit from a personal finance course, whether that gets done through the legislature or through a ballot campaign. You know, we're agnostic. We just want to see it get done.
Okay.
The fact of the matter is, early polling shows 80% plus support for this.
This would be a semester-long course. Now, we already had the legislature mandating ethnic studies. If this were to pass, then it would be another mandate on local districts. You know, what do you say to those who contend this really is better decided at the local district level, better not for legislators or for voters to be putting curricular mandates on districts?
I'll give you 2 numbers. The first is less than 1%. That's the percentage of high school students in California that currently benefit from a standalone personal finance course. 80 to 85%. That's the percentage of adults. And frankly, we've heard it from students themselves that say this is not only a need in the public schools, but it's an urgent need. So I think when there's that much of a disconnect between what's happening on the ground and what folks desire, I talk to a lot of adults about what I do. What's the first reaction they have? It's a class they wish they had. And so I think we're trying to close that gap between what people say they want and the beauty of an initiative, right? It's direct democracy. We'll get an opportunity to hear directly from the people.
Now, you grew up in East Palo Alto in the Bay Area, and you've been a personal finance teacher over the summer. You've done this. So what have you seen with the actual students with whom you've worked? How has this changed them?
Yeah, just a quick correction. So I actually grew up on the East Coast. However, I've been a California resident for the last 32 years. And my passion for this subject came from teaching in a high school in East Palo Alto. And what I saw was the thirst for knowledge that young people had for this. And then the secondary effect, there's a very real ripple effect. When you bring these lessons to students, they take the lessons home to their parents. So when I started to get emails from parents asking about budgeting questions or how they could start investing for retirement, I was hooked because I saw there's a tremendous leverage in bringing this into classrooms because it affects families. And frankly, the third effect we see is that it impacts teachers. You know, teachers, as they are teaching this course, they continue to grow in their own knowledge and they see their own financial lives benefit.
All right, we're talking with Tim Ranzetta, co-founder of NextGen Personal Finance, a nonprofit providing free personal finance classes and professional development, also working with middle and high school teachers. If you have questions for him about this ballot initiative that they are turning over to the Secretary of State so that it can be approved for placing on the ballot, we're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. Or you can email us your question at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. So this could potentially be on the November ballot of this year. Is that right, Tim?
That is correct.
All right. And so your polling shows that there's tremendous support for this. Do you anticipate, if it qualifies, that there would be organized opposition to it?
Yeah, I will say that our strategy has been not only in California, but in states across the nation when we're advocating is to have conversations with all the stakeholders who have an interest in ensuring not only the passage of this, but also ensuring that it's implemented well. And I think that's how we've gotten school groups who we've partnered with closely in states, both within California, we're having conversations today with those stakeholders, as well as we've had in the past, is the fact that we're willing to invest in the implementation, because ultimately this is about a highly qualified, confident teacher teaching an engaging, up-to-date, relevant curriculum. That's ultimately the objective here. And we're committed not only to this initiative passing, but also ensuring that it's done well. And so we've made a down payment in California, anticipating that the need for increased access and there would be changes on the horizon. So we've invested in the four of the largest districts here in California, so they could start to lay the groundwork. What does that mean? It means there's a personal finance specialist in those districts that's supporting teachers, both on the professional development side, as well as on the curriculum support. And then we're also providing stipends to encourage teachers to participate. So, you know, the number you mentioned earlier, I should have updated. You know, we work with close to 100,000 teachers nationwide, including 6,000 in California. And so we know there's a tremendous excitement that teachers have about wanting to do more. And frankly, that's been another impetus for this initiative, is teachers saying, we'd like to do more. We'd like to teach more kids. Because once you've seen the impact in the classroom, it's hard to let go. No student leaves a personal finance course saying, how am I going to use this in my real life? In many cases, they're implementing it immediately.
How do you deal with the fact that students are going to be at very different levels? You're going to have some students who know virtually nothing about personal finance and, in fact, may have some faulty ideas about it because their parents haven't been particularly competent in handling the household finances. You have others who are coming from much more financially literate families, may have been in on decisions family members have made about rent or homeownership or credit card debt, things like that. So how do you make sure the class is interesting for students who know more, but doesn't leave behind students who know less or might have some incorrect knowledge?
Yeah, so I think we start our semester course. It starts actually with behavioral economics, really understanding the psychology behind the money decisions we make. And we think that's a really important starting point so we can get out those myths and misconceptions that students might have. To your question about the students who have an understanding, I think this course is comprehensive enough that every student will learn something. So for example, many students across the spectrum really don't have an understanding of credit scores or how credit cards get used. I mean, we see statistics like 30% of young people not knowing the difference between a debit and a credit card. And so I think the second piece
is, wow,
there's a lot of group projects. And so it's the ability for young people to talk among themselves. And so those who have more understanding, you know, there's nothing better than hearing from a peer. I'll just one anecdote I remember from teaching my class. We were talking about overdraft fees, right? The fees that banks charge, $35 if you take more money than you have in your account. And I could stand up there and say, hey, this is a real danger that $5 coffee you get from Starbucks could cost you $40. But it was so much more powerful when a student raised their hand and said, that's what was on my bank statement. That was a ripoff. I'm not going to let that happen again, mm-hmm. right? it's really powerful for young people to be able to share their experiences.
Tim, before I let you go, I wanted to ask a question from listener Charles in Whittier, who says, personal financial literacy and economics aren't really any different. We already have an economics requirement, and high school economics should focus on basic financial concepts rather than more advanced ones such as macroeconomic theory. Your response to that?
Yeah, I think the way the current economics course, if you go in and look at the standards that are taught, and when you talk to teachers and students about what's being taught in the economics course, it's about 2 weeks. And we think that's really shortchanging young people because you're not giving enough time to a course that every student is going to need to master. And so I think it's too little what's currently in there. And I think economics tends to be more theoretical, while personal finance tends to be much more practical.
Tim, thank you. Appreciate your talking about the initiative that you funded and pending the certification of the Secretary of State, potentially on the November ballot. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. I can't imagine a better investment that I can make. You know, just one last statistic to share, and that is the recent study report came out saying the lifetime benefit of a personal finance course is $127,000. For California students. This is an investment you can't afford not to make.
I'm still shocked that 30% of high school students don't know the difference between a debit card and a credit card. That's concerning. Tim Ranzetta, co-author of the petition we're talking about, co-founder of Next Gen Personal Finance, the nonprofit. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Thank you for your support. You know, it used to be that community banks, credit unions, they're nonprofit, of course, had a difficult time competing with the big banks, the Bank of America's, the Wells Fargo, the Citi's, and others, because it was difficult for them to offer the full array of services, even with their ATM networks and avoiding fees. It could be much more challenging. But now some of those community banks and credit unions, which of course have consolidated and got bigger over time, are finding that they have some competitive advantages over the big guys. And so that's leading some people to consider making these moves to the smaller community-based banks or credit unions. Joining us is Amani Moise, who is personal economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal and is writing about this. Imani, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what are some of the things that the smaller competitors are able to do that it's harder for the huge banks to offer?
Well, we've seen that smaller banks and credit unions, they tend to offer more competitive rates. So that means higher interest on savings products and lower interest on loans. But that for a long time wasn't enough to convince a lot of consumers to make the switch. The biggest reason when I talked to consumers to figure out why you are switching from larger institutions was customer service. Just the ability to walk into a branch, talk to a real human being, pick up the phone, talk to someone that you recognize is driving a lot of people back to their hometown banks.
And is there also a feeling of any sort of loyalty or like wanting to support a bank that's based in their community? Is that part of this, or is it just a matter, you know, the returns are better at the smaller banks?
That's part of it. I think the people that I spoke to, at least, were more driven by customer service, but a lot of them also were small business owners. So there is that sentiment of, I'm a small business owner. I want to support another small business. I want to support an institution that's also investing in this community and not necessarily taking my deposits and investing it elsewhere.
So where are the mid-sized banks? Because in your piece, it sounds like the big banks, you know, they're holding their own. The community-based banks are getting more depositors. But what about the mid-level banks? Where are they in this?
That's a really great question. And I talked to some industry analysts about this, but the mid-sized banks are kind of in a hard spot because we've seen this narrative for a really long time. The big banks, they keep getting bigger and it just feels inevitable, right? Like there's a lot of momentum helping the Chase, Bank of America's of the world continue consolidating, as we saw when Chase bought First Republic. These banks are only getting larger, but people still very much like the the high contact, the high customer service feel of these smaller institutions. And then if you're in the middle, what do you really have to offer? How do you differentiate yourself? So I think that's going to be a question that the super regionals, as they're called, will have to answer going forward.
We're talking with Wall Street Journal personal economics reporter Imani Moiz with us on Air Talk. Also joining us is fee-only certified financial planner and registered investment advisor Delia Fernandez. Delia, good morning. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks for inviting me.
So what do you think of this move?
I think it makes a lot of sense. It even happened to me as a small business owner. My bank got bought out by another bank. And it makes you look around and say, what's really important to me when it comes to banking? And I completely understand that issue of wanting to support another small business.
And so what is the advantage you're finding with a smaller, more locally based bank than you did with your bought out bigger bank?
Well, I'm finding more personal contact. I actually have somebody that I get to talk to, somebody that I get to email and call, which is very helpful to me as a business banker. Personal, I'm lucky to have a credit union relationship, and I love credit unions. They give that high touch, high contact, personal service that we all are looking forward to. But I really appreciate having somebody I can call on and making sure that I understand what the bank offers me.
When I actually wait in the line for a teller at the credit union that I'm a member of, it's like the tellers know seemingly everybody in the line. It's amazing how that works. And the credit union I belong to actually just sent out that they're merging with another one because they're such a little entity. But that littleness is kind of part of the appeal, Delia.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Who doesn't love going into an institution where your money is and somebody actually knows who you are and says hello? How nice is that?
So what if with your business account, have you found any downside with the new smaller bank?
Not yet. I had an interim bank that took over my banking relationship, and I was very unhappy because they weren't offering things like images of checks that I had deposited online. So now I'm looking at the other smaller bank. I've moved an account over there, and I'm in the midst of trying to switch. But, you know, changing all of those automatic payments and deposits, all of those things, it's just logistics. It just gets down to logistics.
Now, Delia, my thought, and I think many people watching the banking industry assume more and more of this would become lower touch, that as we move from everything being done online and bank branches getting smaller, fewer people working in the banking industry on the customer support side of things, and obviously we've had ATMs for decades now, that this would become much less of a human business. But what you're saying is people still crave that. They want a person to deal with.
Well, they crave it, particularly when they need service. I can't get a response from my mobile app the way I can when I talk to a personal banker. We all want the convenience and the low connection until we absolutely need the service. And when we need it, we need it.
Now, online banks, of course, are kind of become the go-to place for people looking for the higher returns on interest that have now been provided with the Fed's action over the past couple of years. Where do the community banks stack up in terms of the interest that they offer compared to the big national banks and the online only?
I think they've been slow to change, but they have had to step up. I've had clients disconnecting the savings part of their banking for a couple of years now to high-yield savings accounts online. And more of them are coming around to it when it can mean not just pennies or a few dollars, but hundreds of dollars on your savings. We don't know how long that's going to last, but consumers have been willing to make that disconnect and go look for those higher yields. But on the other hand, the community banks with lower overhead have the opportunity to raise their rates. And, you know, as the article pointed out, a lot of people just don't want to take the effort to separate out their banking to more than one place. They want to be in one place.
Delia Fernandez, a fee-only certified financial planner and registered investment advisor. Also with us, Wall Street Journal personal economics reporter Imani Moise. So Imani, are there factors that could affect this in the future that could make it more difficult for these local banks to be able to compete and pick up those customers that want more personalized service?
I actually think it's only going to get easier. I haven't run these numbers maybe in a year or two, but the last time I checked, the pace of consolidation in the banking industry has actually slowed down a lot. So in my story, I feature one customer who he was a part of a community bank, but then his bank got bought by Huntington in 1997. And then 25 years later, he switched back to a community bank. And then 25 years later, that community bank got bought by another bank, which got bought by another bank, which got bought by Huntington in 2021. So he's finding it's just harder to find small banks, but that story is starting to change. Granted, we're still kind of on this arc towards consolidation, but the smaller banks aren't closing quite as fast. And I think one of the reasons that's happening is all of the changes in technologies that we've seen. So there's been a lot of investment in fintech and what we call banking as a service. Mm-hmm. So effectively, it's just easier for the community banks to outsource a lot of their tech things to keep up with the bigger guys.
Joe in Chatsworth said, I had someone at Citibank advise me to open an account at a local credit union. I followed the advice. I've since moved my personal accounts. If any issues come up, I can just walk in and talk to a human. Isn't that amazing, Joe? Thanks so much. And my thanks to our guests, Imani Moise of Wall Street Journal, Delia Fernandez, fee-only certified financial planner based in Los Alamitos. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
She's been a frequent guest with us on Air Talk. She's a physician, a chef, an expert on nutrition, and brings those multiple hats to her appearances with us on Air Talk. And we're so glad she's in Southern California today to join us for the first time in studio. Dr. Chef Linda Hsu, internal medicine physician and director of culinary and lifestyle medicine at Kaiser Permanente San Francisco. She also wears yet another hat of clinical associate professor of medicine for the Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine, which, as some of you know, is right here in Pasadena, just a few blocks from our studios here at LAist. Dr. Hsu is also author of Spicebox Kitchen, full of recipes. Thank you so much, Linda, for joining us. Great to meet you in person.
You too, Larry. Thank you so much for having me here.
So share with us how this course in culinary medicine is being taught. How are you trying to influence this next generation of physicians?
Oh, it's so exciting. So I worked with a team at the Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine for literally 3 years on this course. And at first, the idea was just to teach the medical students how to cook for health, for both their personal wellness and for their future patients. But then it became a bigger thing where we thought it was also important to teach them how to work as a part of an interdisciplinary healthcare team and also do some service learning. So those are all the components of this class. But the heart of it, the part that I'm teaching, are twice a week sessions on healthy cooking and what we're calling the healthy cooking lab in the beautiful teaching kitchen there.
And this obviously is something maybe more appealing for students than some of their core classes as a part of. Are you finding there's enthusiasm for this?
Oh, sure. There's food, right?
Yeah. And it's fun to cook.
It is really fun to cook. It's really fun for me to teach. I get actually emotional about it because it's the class I would have wanted to have in medical school decades ago, but it didn't exist.
And this is also, you know, a nutrition class in a sense, because mm-hmm. you can't have one without the other. How much, when you were going through medical school, how much time was devoted to that nutrition and the importance of meal planning and preparation for general health?
Zero.
Really? Nothing?
Yeah. So there is a requirement that medical schools devote about 25 hours throughout the 4 years of medical school to nutrition. But what I remember from what I, and I don't think it was 25 hours, it might have been, but what I remember was being taught really like the biochemistry of nutrition, things about, you know, what do vitamins and minerals do, maybe what goes into a tube feeding formula for patients in the hospital. Nothing actually about food, and also nothing about cooking. And I think that is a real gap, and that's why I'm excited to fill that gap.
Now, are these docs or docs in training for primary care medicine or a variety of specialties that they're pursuing?
Yeah, the exciting thing for me, before I came here, I didn't know what specialties they were going into, and they actually were all fourth year, so they just found out where they're going last week for residency. We have a couple, I think, a couple of primary care doctors, but then other specialties, general surgery, dermatology, anesthesia, and OBGYN. And I have to say, I was so happy to see that because each of these students chose and were on waiting, there was a waiting list to get into this elective. And to know that it wasn't just primary care doctors, which is what I thought would be taking the elective, was really important to me, that they understood that in whatever field they went into, and nutrition was going to be an important part of their patients' lives.
My sense is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there often has been a lack of coordination between nutritionists, dietitians, and physicians. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, is this also designed to help the students really become more conversant in nutritional planning and to help them work with nutritional professionals along the way of their career?
Yes, exactly. That's the reason why we included the portion of the course that is devoted to shadowing people in our Center for Healthy Living, which is the health education department. They're working alongside dietitians, health educators, and others who educate patients about how to implement nutrition recommendations into their health. So the intent is not to create medical students who are also registered dietitians. It's so that they know when to refer, know what questions to be asking their patients, and know what information to share with the dietitians to really help booster that relationship and get the most out of that referral.
And what are some of the things that some of the specialties could work on when it comes to planning? You know, someone who's an oncologist, for example, mm-hmm. are there specific kinds of advice they can give patients that maybe they would learn through your course or that mm-hmm. would open the door to greater learning in that area?
Yeah, actually, one of the students plans to go into oncology after he does his internal medicine residency. And from that perspective, there's a big role for food and nutrition in both prevention of cancer and also support during treatment for cancer, and then after treatment is completed for prevention of relapse. So there are really specific foods that there's evidence for. You know, this is all an evidence-based scientific course, not just, you know, kind of what the latest fad is out there. That is really important for people to know and that students wouldn't otherwise really get training in.
Whenever I hear it, and you're an exception to this, but whenever I hear doctors usually talk about food, mm-hmm. it's so clinical, it's mm-hmm. so unappetizing
yeah.
that you immediately, I think, people get a little defensive about any advice a physician gives about diet.
Mm-hmm.
Are there ways that physicians can really, I mean, you've mastered this, express it in a way that gets people excited about it and gives them an understanding that the food can taste great that they're switching to?
I think that is the number one thing. I always like to say flavor is first, you know, have a flavor forward approach to it. And so when I talk to patients, I try to be very open-ended and show that I'm non-judgmental. And I like to start with, what do you like to eat? There's no wrong answer here.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, well, let's give an example for that. So someone says, well, I like to eat sugar and fat.
Okay.
How do you, what are you going to say to that?
Okay, you're making it a little tough here. But I would say that there is actually room for everything in a life and in a healthy diet. It's sort of the frequency and the amount of things. And so I like to have a more positive approach because I think what people hear is don't eat this, don't eat that. And then you shut down, right? You think, then I'm not going to do it because I like those things.
Well, you could say caramelized onions, for example.
Yeah.
You get a little bit of that sweetness that comes from the natural. natural, you know, what's given off in making onions.
Exactly. So for someone who, like, for example, says, I really love sugar, I have a sweet tooth, which I actually do, then I say, well, you know, if you're going to have dessert, make it count. Have a small bite. Share it with somebody, have it less frequently. You know, don't skip your birthday cake. But from day to day, maybe get used to the sweetness that's in, you know, fruit and other produce. After a while, your palate will change. I think that's a big thing for people. They think, I can't, I really like that. Yeah. That your palate will change in about 4 weeks and you'll really be able to taste more.
Well, and this is something people who've had to cut salt intake often find is once they get off the salt, they're actually tasting other things much more present, and the need for salt often is diminished.
Yes, I talk about salt a lot in my cooking classes because that's a common one. Although, you know, sort of the summary of that is most of the added and excess sodium in our diets is from processed foods. But in cooking, if you need to really cut back on salt, I like to say, well, then try other flavors, try spices, try herbs, and try acids. Acidic flavors can mimic salt.
Very good. And of course, as we're finding with more and more people going on the new generation of weight loss drugs, that doesn't necessarily resolve things because as people eat less, often the lack of balance in their diet becomes even more acute, right? And so so meal planning becomes even more important to make sure people are getting a balanced diet as they eat less.
Yes, I think that's really important that it's, you know, we are stepping away from the sort of generations old wisdom that it's just the calories, and it's not just the calories. The nutrition is what counts. So, you know, I say the flavor first. You got to enjoy it, and you have to find healthy foods that you want to eat, but then it does have to be balanced. You know, most people are actually fiber deficient, and that's in fruits and vegetables and whole grains and beans. Our country is focused on protein. Most people are not protein deficient.
All right. You mean that we can't just add fiber to everything and that would supplement it all?
You could do that, but it's not the best way.
Yeah, it would change how that processed food eats. Thank you, Dr. Hsu. We appreciate it. Great to talk with you again.
See you. Thank you so much.
Dr. Linda Hsu, Chef Hsu as well, internal medicine physician, director of culinary and lifestyle medicine at Kaiser Permanente San Francisco. But she's here in Southern California because she's also clinical associate professor of medicine at Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine, which is based here in Pasadena. She's also author of the cookbook Spice Box Kitchen.